Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And that is Let There Be Drums from Sandy Nelson. It's a great way to just get things moving, all right? And really glad to be doing the show today. At the back end of the show, we have a special treat, Sam Poward and Douglas Blackman. You're going to be listening to an interview I did with them at the Sundance Film Festival about their new film, Slavery by Another Name, based on Blackman's book of the same title. Before that, we'll be talking with Sansara Taylor, welcoming Sansara back to the show. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper, a host of WBAI's Equal Time for Free Thought, and she's a member of the Advisory Board of World Can't Wait. We're going to be talking with her about the war on women and the launching of a new movement to take this on full force and in the streets. But opening the show up, I really wanted to play this to sort of contextualize the whole thing. And this is a segment from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And it's taken from a talk he gave a number of years ago called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And listen to this segment, and we'll be right back to join Sansara in discussion about the big subject. So this is a world of rape and sexual assault.
Think of this fact. Between one-fourth and one-third of all women in the U.S., will be raped or sexually assaulted in their lifetimes. A woman is raped almost every minute in this country. Now, this makes me think of something that the great African-American novelist and writer Richard Wright put into the beginning of one of his books, Big Boy Leaves Home. It's a story also that begins in the rural South. It's a story of some young black boys who go out for have a little fun one day. They go down for a walk by the river. They're having fun with each other the way kids do. They're laughing and playing. They're walking along the edge of the river, and all of a sudden they take a turn in the river, and there is a white woman bathing in the river. And suddenly they're struck with terror because they know through no fault of their own and purely by the accident of making that curve in the river, their lives are now in danger. That they could be lynched just for coming upon this white woman in this way. And this same kind of situation exists for women throughout the society. You go shopping. Maybe you have to go at night because you work during the day. You come out of the store. If the lights aren't working in the parking lot, or if you're parked in the wrong place, you have a real fear of being attacked and raped. If you're walking down the street and there's a place there that's a little bit hidden where somebody could be hiding, you have a real fear of being attacked and raped. If you go the wrong place at the wrong time, or if you do something that some ass says means you asked for it, you could be attacked and raped. Now, Elaine Boozler is a comedian. She got at this point in a way of using humor to illustrate a very serious and deadly thing. She told about how, in one of her routines, she told about how she came out of a movie with a male friend of hers, a good friend, and he said, oh, it's a beautiful night. Why don't we go for a walk down by the river? And she said, well, maybe it's safe for you, but I don't think I'm going for a walk down by any river. It's late at night, it's dark, and I'm carrying a vagina. Now, this is a way to use humor to make a deadly serious point. And another cold statistic captures a real horror lived by women every day. A woman is battered in the U.S. every 15 seconds. And by far, this is done most often by their boyfriends or husbands, who have been trained and conditioned to view these women not as equal partners, but as something like their property, their possession, and a breeder of their children. For most of the time the United States has existed, and even within the lifetimes of many people still alive today, there were laws in many states in the U.S. which, in terms of the rights of persons, did not include women in the category of persons with these rights. And these laws and the customs that went along with them openly treated women as inferior and subordinate to their husbands and to men in general. As I pointed out in the book, Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones, up until less than 20 years ago, there were still states in the U.S. where there was no such thing as marital rape, where a husband could legally force his wife to have sex with him whether she wanted to or not. And for most of the history of this country, this was a situation for wives in general. And then there is the move, backed and encouraged from the highest offices of the land, to keep cutting back and ultimately to take away from women the right to have an abortion. Upholding and fighting for the right of abortion is a crucial part of fighting for the emancipation of women in the fullest sense. It is a crucial part of freeing women from every form of domination and oppression by men, breaking the chains on half the human race, enabling women to take part fully and equally in every sphere of society, and in the struggle to radically change all of society. Denying women the right to abortion, denying them the right to decide when or if they will have children, with everything that means and all the effects that will have on their lives. Denying this is like battering and rape. Denying the right to abortion is a means of exercising forcible control by a male supremacist society over the very lives of women and over their bodies.
All right, welcome back. That was Bob Avakian, and that was A World of Rape and Sexual Assault. You can access that excerpt or hear the entire presentation that it's drawn from at revolutiontalk.net. I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show Sansara Taylor, as I mentioned before, a writer for Revolution Newspaper and on the advisory board of World Can't Wait. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. I'm glad to be with you.
Great. Good to have you back. You know, it's the last time you were on. You caused a whole lot of uproar, and it was really good.
Glad.
It was really good. Yeah, very good. So I wanted to jump into this just so we can get as much covered in the time that we have. You've listened to Avakian talk about this whole assault on women, this overall situation of the dehumanization, degradation, and the attacks on women. And you've talked about this, and it's clear in a lot of ways that this, since Avakian made this speech, that the situation has intensified really tremendously. It's gotten even worse. And you've described it as an all-out war against women. And you've also said that, but by and large, this is unrecognized for what it is. Can we talk about that a little?
Yes, I think that's very important. Since that talk was given, a very powerful talk from Avakian, we've seen the escalation of this attack on abortion to the state where currently there's an all-out assault on birth control and the very notion that women should be able to have the ability to have sex without getting pregnant, which is not just that there's an attack on women's right to have sex. It's the idea that women should be pregnant, they should be dropping out of school, they should be foreclosing their futures, they should be shamed, they should be called sluts in the national media, and not just by one person, but in such a way that it becomes a national debate and controversy for a 30-year-old woman to use birth control. This is from the one end. And from the other end, there's been an increasingly violent, increasingly hateful, increasingly brutal and humiliating content to pornography, even as pornography becomes more and more and more mainstream. And we're always told that these are different. There's the church, and then there's being sexually liberal, or there's degradation in sex, or you can be pure and abstinent. Actually, there's no difference fundamentally between the church's view of women and pornography's view of women. And both of them reduce women to things. They strip them of their humanity, reduce them to things. The church wants to reduce women down to breeders and incubators and fetuses. And the pornographers want to reduce women down to sex objects to be degraded and abused. And women are neither. Women are human beings, and it's essential and it's critical that people fight until all women are recognized as such. And just a word on the denial. People have become so acclimated to the hatred and vitriol against women, to the assaults on women's lives, on their rights, on their futures, that they don't even recognize that we are experiencing a war on women. We've gone out and people say, why are you so angry? All the time, why are you so angry? Well, because I've not acclimated myself to this. I recognize it. And if you're not furious, then you've grown accustomed to it. And it's the situation where woman haters can scream at the top of their lungs, where new cardinal Timothy Dolan out of New York here, the head of the Catholic bishops, can screech that women should not have the right to birth control. And he gets a call to appease him from President Obama. Where Rush Limbaugh can call Sandra Fluke a slut in national media and change the whole terms of debate in society. And we are out there fighting this war, building resistance, and women are coming and telling us in whispers and through tears the stories of their rapes. as if they should be ashamed of what happened to them, or the stories of the obstacles and the hurdles that they went through to get an abortion. We've had women tell us in tears that they feel bad because they never heard anybody say that they shouldn't feel bad for having an abortion. We've had people through tears tell us on the street to strangers that they are humiliated because we are criticizing porn. Every boyfriend they've ever had, these young women tell us, every boyfriend they've ever had has begged them to let them ejaculate in their face, which is standard in pornography, and that they're humiliated and embarrassed to admit this. This has to change. The voices who are outraged about the treatment of women have to come out. We have to make them heard. This has to be acceptable to be outraged and loud and forceful about expressing that. And the people who hate women, the people who are assaulting their lives and their rights, they need to be put on the defensive. That the war on women is not recognized because it's largely so one-sided.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, a writer for Revolution Newspaper. Sansara, you know, yeah, it's very heavy. And part of this thing, when you think about it, I was thinking about this point about denial and the fact that there's not the commensurate response. And yet, you know, there is a point, I know you've talked about this a lot on your blog and in other places. You know, you've talked about what you were saying, that the really gripping testimony from women when they actually break this down and talked about it, when they actually, you know, when it's brought to the surface. But for a lot of people, and around this relation to this denial, for a lot of people, there is this sort of jaded outlook, a sort of thing of, well, we've been there, we've done this before, what can we do? It's reasserting itself. It's a reassertion of human nature, or even that it's just cyclical, it's a repeat of history, we'll come out of this and all this stuff. And, you know, it's the denial and acclimating themselves. And actually, in a large part, that actually makes people who take that up and roll with that actually end up becoming complicit in the furthering of this and the enforcing of this whole thing, this whole war. Can you talk about that? And where is this war coming from? How would you answer that when people say, look, it's just human nature, it's just cyclical?
Well, it's definitely not just human nature. It is the nature of people as they've been shaped and conditioned, living under a system that has patriarchy woven into its foundation and its fabric, and a system that is coming after thousands of years of other class societies. We live in a capitalist, imperialist world today, but years of other class societies that had patriarchy woven into its fabric and foundation. If we don't want to keep fighting the battles over birth control, if we don't want to keep being thrown back and fighting and refighting the question of rape and whether it's a woman should be stigmatized for being raped, whether we should tell a woman what she should do to avoid being raped, or whether we should tell men to stop raping and actually change the culture so they're not socialized to see sex as degradation, which is what porn teaches young boys. That if we want a world where we're not continuously refighting the battles that people felt they won, we need a revolution. We need a different system. Digging up the divisions in the classes, which gives rise to and reinforces the need for patriarchy, the need for the state and the church and the other institutions of power to control women's reproduction, because that controls inheritance lines, it controls property relations. We are still living in a world marked by that. You need to dig that up, and you also need a revolution that takes the liberation of women, the full liberation of women, as a driving force all the way through, starting now and even in the revolutionary society until full emancipation has been won. This is the revolution that Bob Avakian has re-envisioned. It's why his work is so essential. He's got a new synthesis of revolution and communism. And it's why he's so passionate in the midst of everything else he talks about. It's so passionate and so substantive in the clip that you played before in insisting that people recognize and not make peace with the violence and degradation that is so common, so pervasive in this society. So ultimately, that's what it takes. And today, we need to be fighting the power and transforming the people for that revolution. We need to be standing up and getting out in the streets and making the refusal to accept this known and challenging others around it. It's this system. I realize you asked that part of a question I haven't spoken to yet. Where is this war coming from? In large part, I'll try to be very brief, in large part, the challenges of the 60s and the women's liberation movement and the broader revolutionary struggles were so, they were tremendous. They were liberating. They were earth-shaking, and they made a huge difference in people's lives and their thinking, and posed many problems to this system, which the system is still not recovered from. A revolution wasn't made, which is why things are going backwards and why that's still needed. But this system has lashed back at those advances precisely because it has patriarchy woven into it and because it's very concerned about the overall stability and cohesion of their empire. At a time when there are great challenges abroad, when there are great economic dislocations, when there are great demographic changes driven by globalization, there are enormous challenges to the national cohesion and the willingness of people in this country to sacrifice for an unjust empire and to be acquiescent with it, that the reassertion of patriarchy, the reassertion of patriotism, those things have always gone hand in hand. So it's a bigger discussion. I've written about this at Revolution Newspaper. I have a piece about this exactly at revcom.us, and I also gave a talk that goes into it more in depth. But to try to capture it briefly, I would say it's the system lashing back and seeking revenge against those who challenged this patriarchy and the system overall in the 60s.
You know, it's interesting, Sansara Taylor, you also have a really great YouTube channel. People should go to that, and there's a lot of your work on there, a lot of very incisive and insightful comments on there. And in fact, people can access your speech at the Revolution Books in New York City website, too. So, you know, one thing, though, Sansara, I was thinking about this in terms of when you're talking about the reassertion of traditional family values, patriarchy, patriotism, all this stuff, and then you've put it in the context of the necessity that the imperialists are facing in the world today. And there's a couple of things that really stand out, I think, and I know these are big, big issues, but if you could speak a little bit to both of these before we get into the character of the movement, because I really do want to get into what you're calling for, the launching of a new movement. Coming up with all of this reassertion and all this stepped up attack is the role of the Christian fascists. I mean, you look at somebody like Santorum, who's actually being taken seriously in the elections this year, or all of this stuff that's going on, the Obama and his conciliation with the Christian fascists. And then in particular, what seems to be more and more acceptable, more and more widespread, well, you started to talk about a little bit earlier, and I'd like to just dig a little bit into the role of violent pornography. That seems to have been really a front in this war that has just skyrocketed ahead as a major assault.
Yeah. I think first to speak to the part of the Christian fascist, Rick Santorum being taken seriously in national politics, and the illusion and the confusion around the role of Obama in this. And I think it's very important because recently you started to hear, and I want to make it clear, I'm talking about the systems war on women. But a lot of people have started to talk about the quote-unquote Republican war on women. And I think calling it a Republican war on women, instead of recognizing that there's a system and a systematic war on women that includes the ruling class as a whole and what they've whipped up among a reactionary male chauvinist social base, calling it a Republican war is a misnomer, it mischaracterizes it, and it demobilizes people. It implies that somehow this is just a surface phenomenon and it's only coming from the Republicans. It implies that somehow the Democrats can be relied on to stop it. And it keeps people looking upwards to the halls of power for somebody to stop this rather than looking out at the millions of people who are outraged and upset or who can be won to be outraged and mobilized to stop this. And calling it a Republican war on women rather than recognizing that it's a systems war on women covers over the fact that the Christian fascists and the bigots who are spearheading the assault on abortion and birth control, this is not them doing this just as some random selection of people. These people were elevated into the halls of power. It began with Ronald Reagan. It continued under Bill Clinton, who was the first Democrat to really concede the moral high ground on abortion, calling for it to be safe, legal, and, quote, rare, as if there's something morally wrong with it, but giving up the moral high ground to Christian fascists who are insisting on forced motherhood. And this continued under the first Bush, under the second Bush. It's also continued under Obama. As much as people try to make believe to themselves that he's something he is not, it meant something. It meant something that Obama invited that bigot, Rick Warren, to give his convocation on his inauguration day. That bigot Rick Warren, who preaches that women should submit to their husbands as husbands do to the Lord, the bigot Rick Warren, who spearheaded the attacks against gay marriage in California, Rick Warren, the science denier who claims evolution is a myth and the earth is 6,000 years old, it meant something that Obama invited that bigot to give his convocation. And ever since then, he has continued to seek common ground and conciliate with the religious fascists. And so everybody was very happy when he called up Sandra Fluke, the Georgetown law student who was so viciously attacked by Rush Limbaugh. But when he did that, it's important to understand, he was not calling and he did not say, I am going to fight uncompromisingly to defend your right to birth control and abortion, and I'm going to stop these religious fascists. That's not what he said. He said, your parents should be proud of you. And the week before, Obama called up Timothy Dolan, the head of the U.S. Catholic bishops, who was the one spearheading the attack on abortion. And he said, I hope I can appease you by making some amendments to my health bill. And when Obama's making these phone calls, calling Sandra Fluke one week and Timothy Dolan the other week, He's doing it because he's concerned about stitching together a reactionary social fabric and holding together the empire. He's doing that as a ruling class figure concerned with social stability, not as somebody who is coming to rescue the lives and the rights of women, which are increasingly under assault. It's a systems war on women, and it requires people to get out, to rely on ourselves, and to change the terms, and to say abortion on demand without apology, forced motherhood is female enslavement. There is nothing to be ashamed of or to be compromising about on the right of women to birth control. So that's on that part, and I'll try to be briefer, but this question of the violent nature of pornography, this is something that is so overlooked, and it's so controversial, even among feminists, even among, you know, progressive and left-minded people, and especially on the college campuses. Even we've had women's studies professors and gender studies professors screaming at us for handing out flyers criticizing pornography. So we, here in New York, where I am, we put out an invitation at Barnard College. It's a women's college where a lot of the controversy had been raging. We put out 500 invitations. Come with us to a porn store in Times Square. See for yourself. You want to defend this? Come look at it. You don't know what you think? Come find it out with us, but see it for yourself. So we took a group of young women to this porn store, and we walked in, and the very first thing we encountered was a wall, ceiling to floor wall, full wall of torture porn. And this was everything that you saw in the pictures of Abu Ghraib, of the torture of the Iraqi detainees by U.S. soldiers there. Everything that you saw in the actual war zones, war crimes, was being depicted and sold of being done to women. Women chained to ceilings for days, raped and beaten over and over again. Women who were chained in stress positions, bound and gagged, being repeatedly raped with mechanized dildos and weapons. Women who were covered in bruises on their faces, women who had terror in their eyes, and women who were literally choking on the urine and the excrement of multiple men at once. This is what was being sold. And all of the women who came with us were utterly shocked. They came and they said, oh, what about feminist porn? What about progressive porn? They had no idea. The level of violence and hatred, the tsunami of hatred and violence against women, which has been unleashed through pornography, one, it's real, and two, it has to be understood as a way that this system, once again, has sought revenge against every advance that women have made. There's almost a direct relationship between the advances women have made in the public, political, and professional spheres and the vicious revenge and toll that's been taken in the private and intimate spheres, including in the field of pornography. To real women's bodies who are in the porn, to the real women who come to us and tell us the stories and the humiliation and degradation that they experience in their own intimate lives, by men who've been deprived of any real sex education and brought to their sexual understanding by this kind of pornography. And so it's really a way that this system has sought revenge, but also sought to unleash and whip up men to be enforcers of this revenge. And men have to get out of it. Women need to recognize that this is not the only way sex can be, men and women both. But men who are into this, you have to understand that you are getting off on the enslavement and degradation of women, and you're getting off in the destruction of somebody else's humanity. And if you do that, you lose your own humanity. There's a whole different way that people need to be and relate, including a different kind of sexuality that people have been denied and deprived any access to. That's about mutual respect and equality and pleasure and exploration, but on the foundation of equality. So this is something that has largely been unrecognized and given a free pass. And it's essential. This is what we're doing this International Women's Day, to connect up the porn and the church. They're different on the surface, but their view of women is the same. They are things to be used and controlled by men. And that is not anything legitimate. That's half of humanity enslaved. And we need to fight for the liberation of women. Women are human beings. Everybody, men and women, all genders, all ages, need to be involved in that struggle.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about the launching of a whole new movement against the war on women. You know, Sansara, I'm really glad you brought that up, and in particular the impact on men and the role that men play as enforcers of this, because, you know, when you were on the show last and we did a whole thing on pornography, one of the most extreme, you know, we had some very good callers, but some of the most extreme responses came to me in emails from men who were just outraged and really vigorously upholding their right to enjoy pornography. They didn't care what it was doing or anything else. They just kept asserting all these things, and really vicious, disgusting emails that came from these guys who are saying, look, this is, you know, this is my freedom to do this. Now, I wanted to talk to this in terms of, in the last, we have about 2 minutes, a little bit under 2 minutes, and I know it's hard to do this, but give people a capsulized understanding of what is this movement? You've called for launching a new movement against this all-out war and a movement that will rock the streets. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we are going into the streets. I know you guys are in L.A., and we are in New York, and people are around the country, and we are not doing a symbolic protest. We are not doing this to appeal to people in power to come and please know that we're upset and we want you to do something. We are launching a new movement. We are ourselves, by going into the streets and collectively expressing our outrage and raising our voices, getting out of the whispers and out of the tears and actually flipping that into fury and articulate, impassioned insistence that people wake up, that we ourselves refuse to accept this. We're shaking off any remnants of passivity and conciliation with this. And we are calling forward, not to those in power, but out to the millions of people in this country who are going along, those who are sick at heart about this, and those who right now think I'm making it up, I'm too extreme. We want you to be challenged and shaken on this, too. We are directing our protest towards everybody who is hearing this to say, you have to join us. There is a future being bolted into place for women, for half of humanity, that has got ever decreasing rights, ever more shame, ever more stigma, ever more degradation and internalization of that by women themselves, and the turning of men into oppressors and vehicles for the system's enslavement of women. We are calling out to you to say this has to stop, and if we stand up against this, if we raise our voices, we can change the terms in every part of society. Voices of anger and outrage against this who are loud, who are uncompromising, and so that those who want to insist on dark ages submission of women or high-tech, so-called glamorized, pornified degradation and enslavement of women, they have to rethink. They have to cower their voices. They have to be in whispers. And they ultimately have to be challenged and deprived of the ability to enforce their rights over women. The last thing I'll say, as long as men have the right to view pornography of women's degradation and enslavement, women will never have the right to walk down the street free of all the harassment, all the objectification, all the humiliation, all the degradation, and all the leers of entitlement that men give them and hostility that follow that. Women will not be able to walk this earth free of that.
All right, Sansar.
All the sexual violence that comes with that, yeah.
All right, thank you very much, Sansar. We'll have you back again real soon. And thanks again for very insightful, very provocative, and very thoughtful presentation.
Okay, thanks, Michael.
All right, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've been talking with Sansara Taylor, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, a host of WBAI's Equal Time for Free Thought, and on the board of World Can't Wait. We've been talking about launching a new movement in the streets against the war on women. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with two filmmakers that I had the opportunity to interview up at the Sundance Film Festival. And that's Sam Pollard, the director of the film Slavery by Another Name, and Doug Blackman, the executive producer of the film, based on his book by the same name. You don't want to miss this, so stay tuned. That's Number Days from Ross Michael, and it's fitting for the next part of the show. As I mentioned earlier, this is a recording, a pre-recorded interview I did with Doug Blackman, the author of Slavery by Another Name, and Sam Pollard, the director of the film by the same name and based on the book Slavery by Another Name. Now, as I mentioned, I got the chance to see this film up at the Sundance Film Festival, and I found it to be a really intriguing, very powerful film. Now, I had read the book, Slavery by Another Name, a couple of years ago when it first came out, and I had the opportunity to interview Doug Blackman at that time. The book opens the door on a whole new chapter of history in this country, and especially the history of black people in this country. It really shines a light on the truth that this society, this system, this country is built on the backbone of the enslavement of the black people. And the film that Sam Power directed on the basis of this book really brings that whole new chapter even more powerfully to life. So check the interview out. I think it provides a lot of insight to the story behind the book and the film, and I think you'll get a lot out of it. So check it out.
I'm really happy to welcome back to the show Douglas Blackman. Doug was on the show when his book, Slavery by Another Name, first came out, and we had a tremendous conversation. A lot of you really enjoyed the book, and it had a deep impact on me, and I've thought a lot about it ever since then. Doug, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back, Michael. It's good to be with you.
You know, you have this book that you put out that had such a deep impact on the world, and now there's a film that's based on the book. And I was really pleased to see that, and the name of the film is the same as the book, Slavery by Another Name. Tell people what that was about. For people who don't know the book, tell them what it's about and what led to this movie.
Slavery by Another Name is the story of how slavery did not, in fact, go away at the end of the Civil War, as we generally learn in our American history classes and from pop culture. After the Civil War, the freed slaves had a period of time in which they enjoyed a relative freedom, but that by 25 or 30 years after the Civil War, slavery began to be reinstituted in the South. It wasn't exactly like the slavery before the Civil War, but it was involuntary servitude and slavery, and it was people being bought and sold, people being kidnapped and sold into forced labor, and what by the beginning of the 20th century had become a new and massive form of involuntary servitude all across the South and the victimized huge numbers of black people. The book is about that history, that sort of forgotten aspect of our past. The film takes that story and tells it again in a very visual and powerful way. But one of the things that's very unique to the film is that after the book came out, I was approached by huge numbers of people who telling me their stories of how they or their families connected back to these events. And so in the film, we have a number of what we call the descendants, but who are descendants of both people who were victimized by these practices, but also of people who did the oppressing. Some of the most terrible characters in the book, their great-grandchildren or other descendants appear in the film talking about what happened and how the story of what they had been told of those people's lives, how different that was from the reality that the book revealed.
One of the things that always struck me about the book is, you know, you have this thing now that's been, and especially very popular all over the country, in the South as well as here, as there's a whole rewriting of history around that period. And one thing is you discovered a certain part of history that very few people knew about. But then there's this rewriting, and that came at the same time as there's been this rewriting of history in terms of the Civil War, what was it fought about. Jim Lowen, who did a lot of those books, Lies My Teacher Told Me, things like that, he did a whole thing on how history makes us dumber, and he did a thing on how he was just astounded when he found out how many teachers in high schools were teaching things like the Civil War was over states' rights and not over slavery. And your book comes out in this context. Do you see any connection there?
Absolutely. Jim Lowen has done a fantastic job through his books of demonstrating how often history is mistaught and how these fairy tales of American history and American mythology have come to dominate the telling of our past. That's not a terribly surprising thing. I mean, that's a human thing to do, is to romanticize and mythologize our past and to try to make it where our history is made up only of heroes and never of villains, or at least to designate the villains very explicitly and in ways that we can manage their part of the story that's told in our history. Absolutely what happened in America at the beginning of the 20th century were, and not just for Southerners, but also for Northerners and all Americans, all white Americans, though it began to affect even the remembered history of African Americans. This idea that the Civil War wasn't about slavery, that it was about independence and sovereignty of the Southern states, when, of course, it absolutely was about slavery. And all you have to do is go back and read the speeches that were being given by the legislators who voted to secede from the Union back in 1861. And so the real importance of that in many respects and how it relates to my book is that slavery is the great failure, the great moral failure of American society. And if you buy at all into the idea that there's something remarkable about America or about the American system or American exceptionalism in any way, if you buy into any version of that, then you still have to acknowledge that slavery is the great failure of American life, and then the even greater failure of the slavery that preceded the Civil War was that after this extraordinary event of the nation making war on itself around the principle of that slavery was wrong, and then slavery is destroyed, slavery is defeated, and then yet our society allows it to return. And in my mind, that is so astonishing a failure of the American system, and it is tragically sad that in the course of that happening, we also had to create this whole new set of fairy tale mythologies that somehow tried to justify the resubjugation of African Americans rather than actually carrying through with what was a noble attempt at some level to bring real citizenship and justice to the formerly enslaved African Americans.
Now, when you talk to people and you talk about this being slavery by another name, you talk about the reinstatement of slavery. I mean, it's really a situation where most people look at it and they think, okay, there must be something more to this story than that. Is this Doug just sort of putting out hyperbole? Is he just trying to create some kind of sensationalism by saying that it was slavery? Was it actually slavery?
What I write about and what we depict in the film is absolute slavery. And I say this to people all the time. That slavery. And by the way, slavery is a word that's misused a lot. It's overused a lot. People are much too inclined to say this is a new kind of slavery or that's a new kind, or that's as bad as slavery. And one of the bad things about that is that it disrespects, in some respects, the terrible things that were done to people who were truly enslaved. But what I write about in my book, what we depict in the film, is slavery. Slavery, look it up in the most basic dictionary. Slavery is when a person is forced to labor against their will without compensation. That's involuntary servitude. That's slavery. If that person is then subject to being bought and sold, that's chattel slavery. The definitions are simple. And what I write about and what we have in the film is not just people having a hard time. It's not terrible poverty. It's not being called a bad name. It's not being forced to go to inferior schools or not being allowed to vote. Terrible, terrible things that should never have happened to black people. But those are not slavery. What we call slavery is the buying and selling of people who were forced against their will to labor for other people for no compensation. So we're talking about real slavery, thousands of people forced into slavery. Now, part of the story that maybe explains this, some people would say these weren't slaves. These are people who had committed crimes, broken laws, and that they were simply being punished for their crimes. My book demonstrated more powerfully than most people believed could be possible, is that there were thousands and thousands and thousands of people who were ostensibly charged with breaking laws and who were sentenced to hard labor and other kinds of involuntary servitude, but who, in fact, had done nothing and had been arrested and forced into labor solely to provide free labor for the new commercial enterprises of the South.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Doug Blackman and Sam Poward. Doug is the author of Slavery by Another Name, and Sam Poward is the director of the film by the same name. You know, one of the things that comes out a lot when people are talking about slavery, they look at it as, well, this is sort of a past connection. It's something that happened in the past. Now you're resurrecting this whole thing, or you're bringing to light for the first time this whole thing about slavery continued to exist, and frankly, all the way up to 1942, to World War II, which we'll get into in a minute. But one of the things that Bob Avakian talked about, and he opens up his new book with the first quote in that, is that there would be no United States today if it were not for the system of slavery. You know, and I think that's something that really comes through in your book, because it's the slavery that began when they first came over here and then continued all the way through, and as your book goes out, all the way to 1942. But the whole constant intermeshing or the basis for even the advancement of capitalism in the whole country depended a lot on the slavery that depended somewhat on the slavery that existed pre-Civil War, but even more so in a certain sense in the slavery that existed post-Civil War and the kind of slavery that you've brought out in your book.
I think I would say that it was essentially the same before the Civil War and after the Civil War, that and no matter what one's political or economic point of view is, that's just a fundamental fact that the economic system of the United States was initially founded on the notion of the widespread use of slavery, not just in the South, but all the way up into New York and New England. You know, it's not until the early 19th century that slavery begins to be really pushed out of the North and relegated to the South. And so slavery is a fundamental element of the economic organization of America from the very beginning. That's what's so miraculous about this almost impossible to imagine thing that that a country that was so wedded to slavery would in fact wage war upon itself to bring it to an end. I mean, it's the most noble thing that arguably that America as a society ever undertook, even with all the complications and contradictions that went along with that, such as that white Northerners were by and large just as racist as white Southerners were. But nonetheless, this miraculous thing that where there is an effort to expel slavery from the economic system of the United States. But then after the Civil War, these new forms of voluntary servitude are resurrected and become just as fundamental to the resurrection of the Southern economy as it had been before. And without that, the Southern economy as a major element of the national economy, it was still a largely agrarian nation in the late 19th century, and slavery is also being used, the new slavery is also being used to build for the first time massive industrial enterprises in the South, railroads, bridges, factories, coal mines, iron ore mines, all of these things are inherently related to this reinstituted involuntary servitude.
You know, it's interesting, too, because I think the thing about actually fighting a war against slavery, even though they had Lincoln, for instance, saying if he could save the Union without freeing the slaves, I'm down for it. You know, but there's always been that kind of underpinning of creating a certain pariah class that, you know, from the very beginning of the country. But there's also something that came out that was, to me, is really striking, because in the book, you document how this continued all the way through, even when people knew it was wrong. And it wasn't something that like, oh, my God, are you kidding me? You know, as it went up the ladder, the political ladder, it wasn't like everybody saying, this is, I don't believe it. You know, but it was people who knew that it was going on, knew that it was wrong, but continued to do it. And it only ended around World War II. Can you talk about that story of people continuing with this, ignoring it, knowing it was going on, ignoring it, knowing it was wrong, allowing it to happen? And then why did they move against it?
Well, the continuation of all of this and the metastasization of it in the first years of the 20th century were inherently related to the abandonment of blacks in the South by whites in the North. It's no surprise that white Southerners had no idea how to proceed without black slaves anymore at the end of the Civil War. That's not a surprise to us. But it's also less obvious to us why white people in the North in the end would give up on this great mission of ending slavery through the Civil War. And the explanation for that is, in fact, that white people in the North were not particularly more enlightened about the inferiority or not of African Americans to whites. Even the most ardent abolitionists before the Civil War generally believed that black people were not exactly the same as white people. And in the years after the Civil War, even among the most progressive-minded people in the country, there was a view that some African Americans would be able to achieve on the level of white Americans, but that most would not. There was just this built-in white supremacy that infected then and to some degree today still infects almost every American person, every American life. This fundamental idea that white people are somehow inherently better than black people are highly likely to be. And so those attitudes were well entrenched all over America. And in the beginning of the 20th century, after 35, 40 years of arguing about the aftermath of the Civil War, and all of the national politics of America had been corrupted and polarized over those decades by the wreckage left behind of the Civil War. And at the beginning of the early 20th century, as some African Americans began to arrive in meaningful numbers in the North, began to compete with white people for jobs, began to pose burdens on public institutions and create additional obligations for states and cities, white people all over the country began to say, why do this? Why allow black people to be full citizens? They're just competitors. And so whites in the North abandoned the freed African Americans at the very moment the whites in the South were setting upon them with incredible viciousness. And the result of that was this terrible period of a half century, essentially, of re-enslavement for huge numbers, not every single African American, but huge numbers of African Americans in the rural South faced this new kind of involuntary servitude. The end of that system really began for two reasons. One was a macro economic explanation, and that was that essentially by the time you get to the 1940s, The tractor has been invented. The first mechanical cotton picker is being used to pick cotton. The research on what will be the first chemical herbicides that can kill the weeds in the fields rather than them having to be manually hoed out. There are these technological changes happening which are making it where in the Deep South it's no longer necessary to have these millions of workers available in the spring and in the fall to chop cotton in the spring and to pick cotton in the fall. So there are these huge economic changes that are beginning to undercut the system. But then when World War II begins, from the very first days after Pearl Harbor, the president and other people in the top levels of the federal government are asking, what are our propaganda vulnerabilities? What are the things that the Japanese in particular will attack us with? And someone in the cabinet, we actually don't know whom, but we know this happened. Someone in the cabinet immediately said, well, the treatment of the Negro. And the attorney general at the time began talking to people at the Department of Justice about what could be done to make some symbolic demonstration on the side of African Americans to make it where black soldiers would be less likely, less vulnerable to a propaganda message that, you know, why are you fighting for the people who oppress you and your people? And in the course of those conversations, someone at the Department of Justice said to the Attorney General at the time, well, you know, there are places in the South where people are still holding slaves, and it's the policy of the Department of Justice not to investigate those cases. And the Attorney General at the time, to his credit, even though he was a fairly serious racist in his own right, but by standards of the day, not a terribly racist person, but fundamentally a white supremacist like so many. But he realized even that was astonishing and immediately ordered that the Department of Justice begin to prosecute these cases. And that I mark as the technical end of slavery in America.
All right. Well, you're one of the executive producers of the film, and walking in the door now is the director of the film, Sam Pollard. Sam, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Sure. You know, you have a history in your films. In the films, you're an editor, director, filmmaker that's, you know, in terms of the collaborations you've done with Spike Lee, the stuff that you've done on your own, you have a deep history of rooting yourself, you know, to a large degree, in and not exclusively, but rooting yourself in the history of black people in America. And understanding that history and trying to bring it out in the most honest, powerful way you can. What I'm getting at is I want to dig a little into what drew you to this film. What made you read this book and think this is a film I need to make? Because, first off, did you know about this history when you first picked up the book?
No, I didn't know about it. And when I read the book initially in galleys, I was just amazed and, like, you know, mortified at what had happened. You know, in that period after the Civil War, up into the early 1940s. So me and another partner had read Doug's Galleys, and we thought this could be a very powerful film. This could be a story that, you know, that we felt needed to be told as a documentary. And so we had reached out to Doug, and our first sort of connection didn't work out, but then when Doug went to TPT and they were looking for a director, Doug mentioned me to Catherine Allen, the other executive producer, and I was excited to be on board because, as you just said, you know, I've been involved with looking at African American history, really penetrating the history for many years, and, you know, much of that inspiration for me in terms of looking at African American history came from my collaborations early in my career with the late St. Clair Bowen. Because when I was first in the business, part of my sort of mentality was that I wanted to feel like I could assimilate into American culture. And as a young film editor, I didn't really want to work on black films. I didn't want to be associated with black films. And then I was very fortunate, after about being in business for 6 years, to work on a film with St. Clair Bowen about the Chicago blues scene. And spending every day for 6 months in the editing room with St., who was proselytizing and preaching about wanting to tell the stories of black people, I said, Saint's got a point. That should be a part of my responsibility, too. And Saint's really inspired me to really understand that that's what I had to do. That was part of my mission. And from that point on, I never said I didn't want to be involved in the making of black films that dealt with African-American history.
You know, it's interesting because one of the last interviews I did with him was when he was receiving a Lifetime Award. It was about maybe 8 months before he died. And he said, you know, I kind of worry about getting these awards because it's like they're saying I'm done. He said, I'll never be done. And
he was never done.
Right. And in a sense, the legacy that he left when he died.
He passed it on to me. He passed on many of us. You know, Stanley Nelson, Louis Messiah, many of us, Charlotte Lynch. And, you know, this is why this story like Slavery by Another Name is so important to me, you know. And it was just groundbreaking to spend time going down to Alabama, going with Doug to many of the places that he had researched, looking through these old files, you know, looking at the convict records and stuff. It was just amazing history to unearth.
Well, when you did that, when you did unearth it and you began to unearth it, you know, still it's a very difficult film to make in a certain sense because, you know, what you've done with this is you have brought that era to life in a way. And I thought it was something, you know, you talked about it in one interview. You talked about it being a challenge because you had this very, very intense material and you had to bring it to life. And you also had to really, I mean, you know, when you're discovering this, it says something when you look at this and you're thinking, I don't know, maybe if you were the same as most people in the country, even though, you know, the legacy of racism and the oppression of black people and the development of a pariah class, and which we'll talk about a little bit later. But, you know, that whole idea that well, this all ended at a certain point. And then you have this. And so you want to bring it back as powerfully as possible. How did you do that?
Well, you know, it was interesting because Doug's book, besides telling the history, he focused on some other characters, which always, to me, is the fantastic thing about storytelling. If you find great characters, it gives you that window into helping to shape and tell the story. So the challenge was, how are we going to do it visually? You know, to tell the story of people that there was no footage of, there were no stills of, to a degree, of his main characters. So, you know, what we decided was the way to tell a story besides the normal route of using historical stills and archival letters, you know, and interviews with historians, we were going to use reenactments, which is always a tricky dance because lots of times in these historical docs, reenactments, if the quality of the production isn't good enough, they can be horrible. They can be horrible. And so one of the things that was important to me was to make sure that we tried to make sure the production level was to such a degree that you couldn't say, ooh, they were really cheesy, that they were special. And we went out of our way to audition as many actors as we could to find the right actors for the roles. We hired a production designer to do really great period recreations. We hired a costume designer to make sure that the costumes were appropriate to the period. That was important. But I think the real key to this film, besides those reenactments, was something that I had initially resisted, was the idea of listening to having our descendants of some of the characters be on screen. Because normally, if you think about having people or descendants, your question is, what are they going to say? What do they know about the history? But it wasn't what they knew. It's what they emotionally took away from when they read Doug's book. The impact of reading Doug's book and realizing that they had to, in some cases, like in the case of Christina Comer and Susan Benor, they had to rethink the stories they had been told about their white ancestors. That, to me, took this film to a completely unique level.
I'm Michael Slade, and we're talking today with Doug Blackman and Sam Pollard. Sam Pollard is the director of the film Slavery by Another Name, and Doug is the author of the book Slavery by Another Name, on which the film is based.
When you have also have black ancestors there, and in terms of learning the story of their ancestors, you know, in terms of this was actually people being held in slavery long after.
Yeah.
You know, that must have had a tremendous impact.
It was impactful. Yeah. And I think it was impactful because when they read Doug's book and they got in touch with Doug, it just blew their minds. I mean, when he heard from this gentleman, Bernard Kenzie, you know, who was connected and related to Carrie Kenzie, when he talked to a woman named Tanya Grooms, who was related to Green Cottonham, they also, their minds were blown about, they didn't know these little nuggets about their families, mm-hmm. the history of the family.
I have two more questions for you.
Sure.
And one of the things is that what Doug points out in his book is the use of vagrancy laws and all kinds of these minor violations that people could get picked up, not any people, but what black people could get picked up for, you know, at the drop of a hat. And violating a vagrancy law, just not having some matching the just on-the-spot determined amount of money in your pocket could end you up enslaved, you know. And I look at that and I think about that now in terms of the kinds of things that are going on around the drug wars, you know, and the idea that, I mean, this, again, there's this whole idea of how the war on drugs developed as sort of a response to the 60s black liberation struggle, mm-hmm. and Nixon telling Haldeman, problems the black people, we got to do something about that without making it seem that way. Mm-hmm. And that response to what comes up today, what Bob Avakian has described as is a counterinsurgency before the insurgency has even begun in a real sense. Mm-hmm. And a real attempt to keep that from developing is what they're doing with these. And, you know, I saw a film that appeared at Sundance that was really remarkable, and it had a lot of mixed things in it, but it was really overall remarkable.
House I Live In.
Yeah, mm-hmm. really intense film. And you look at that, and that kind of similarity between the war on drugs and what was developing in...
Back in the 80s.
Yeah. What do you think about that?
It's, you know, it's an understanding that there's a trajectory of the history that is a continuum to this history that people need to be aware of. That people of color who have been marginalized and disenfranchised, it existed in the 1880s and 1890s and the early part of the 20th century, and it exists today. And the government does it in different insidious ways, you know, mm-hmm. insidious ways. And it's also about economics. And it's an amazing thing to understand it, to realize, if you're smart and you realize that people of color have had to struggle in this country for many years to deal with things. I mean, you can look at what happened in the 1880s with creating these laws to incarcerate people of color in the South, or the Rockefeller drug laws, you know, that incarcerate people for holding one little small bag, you know.
With a stop and frisk today.
Stop and frisk, yeah.
Yeah, really intense. All right, well, thank both of you very much.
My pleasure.
Sam Power, the director of the film, Doug Blackman, author of Slavery by Another Name and one of the co-executive producers of the film, and thanks a lot for all the work you've done.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
All right, welcome back. That was Doug Blackman and Sam Poward and about their film Slavery by Another Name. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Henry Carson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. And I want to leave you with this one thought. You know, the world, if we learn anything, if we get anything out of today's show, it's this. The world as it stands today is a complete and utter horror. But it doesn't have to be this way. It's not because of human nature or anything else, but this system. It's this system of imperialism that causes it, and what it's going to take to change it fundamentally and bring on a whole new world is revolution. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a song from the Chieftains. It's a cover of one of my favorite Bob Dylan songs, When the Ship Comes In, and the Chieftains bring their own unique flavor to it, so check it out. Talk to you again next week.
Oh, the time will come when the winds will stop and the breeze will cease to be breathing, like the stillness in the wind before the hurricane begins, the hour that the ship comes in. Oh, the seas will split and the ship will head, and the sands on the shoreline will be shaking. Then the tide will sound and the winds will pound, and the morning will be a-breaking. Oh, the fishes will laugh as they swim out of the pan, and the seagulls, they'll be smiling, and the rocks on the sand will proudly stand the hour that the ship comes in. And the words that are used for to get the ship confused will not be understood as they are spoken, for the chains of the sea will have busted in the night and be buried at the bottom of the ocean. A song will lift as the mainsail shifts and the boat drifts out to the shoreline, and the sun will respect every face upon the deck the hour that the ship comes in. And the sand will roll out a carpet of gold for your weary toes, be it touching, and the ship's one.